This episode of Nigerian American contains strong language. The events I'm about to speak on are true and delicate, and may be offensive to some audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Real names of the characters in this episode have been changed to protect their identity. In episode 1, I talked about growing up in Kaduna in the northern part of Nigeria, and I gave a bit of a picture of what growing up in Kaduna was like. To summarize, I had a calm and laid-back, mostly suburban childhood, and I only visited Lagos on family holidays. Lagos is sort of like the New York of Nigeria. Big city, very busy, very loud, and densely populated. It was always a wild experience whenever we visited Lagos. It was a truly chaotic place. And I never imagined it would one day become my reality to live there. My dad is originally from Lagos. He was born and raised there. My mom, on the other hand, is from a small town in the western part of Nigeria called Ijebu-Ode, but she was raised in Kano, another big city in northern Nigeria, also densely populated, but way less chaotic as compared to Lagos. My mom moved to Kaduna from Kano for work, and that's where she met my dad, who was also working in Kaduna then. Anyway, I traveled a lot as a kid, but Kaduna was our base. I liked it, you know, it was very laid back, and I really enjoyed growing up in Kaduna. It was much like growing up in a US suburb. My family moved to Lagos in 1993 while I was in 10th grade, or SS2 like it's called in Nigeria. But my mom wanted me to complete high school in Kaduna before going to join the rest of the family in Lagos, so I stayed back in Kaduna with my best friend and his family. I graduated in the summer of 1994 and moved to Lagos shortly after. At the time, my family lived on the outskirts of Lagos and things were a bit less crazy there. So it was a busier version of what I was used to, but not as chaotic as where my dad's house was when I used to visit. So I didn't experience the chaotic city life unless I went out to the busier parts, which I rarely did. Shortly after I moved to Lagos, my dad canceled my plans of schooling abroad and insisted I must attend a local university in Nigeria. I really hated that. And I resented him for it for a long time. He dragged me to the University of Lagos and talked his way into my admission. It kind of was a very easy sell to the Dean of Environmental Sciences at the time. I mean, I had one of the best JAMB scores in the entire country that year. JAMB is like the Nigerian version of the SATs. I also had 9 A's in my senior school certificate exams. That's also known as SSCE. So I was a smart kid, but that's not what the story is about. Anyway, I got admitted for architecture and began my journey into the exploration of city and campus life. I remember how intense the culture shock was for me. Lagos was a totally different place. It was brutal. It was nothing like Kaduna. I didn't like it very much, but I knew I had to adapt very quickly if I was going to make it through university life. In this episode, I'm going to tell you about some of my experiences in my first year at the University of Lagos. I had just completed my student registration. It was a week-long process, had me running from building to building all across the campus. Even back then, I thought it was a bit of a ridiculous process that I had to physically go all over the campus just to complete my registration. The only way it made sense to me was that it may have been designed that way in order to help new students get familiar with the campus. But anyway, it was just annoying. I began the registration process a lot later than most people did, so I was one of the last to show up in my class, and one of the first few things I had to figure out was how to cut my 2.5 hour commute from home and another 2.5 hour commute back home every day. The traffic was insane, and I couldn't find any accommodation on campus because I joined late and they were all already taken. So I asked around for anyone who was willing to let me either share a dorm room, a bunk bed, or purchase the accommodation allocation outright. It was common practice for those who didn't really need the campus dorm room allocation to sell it to desperate people like me. I initially didn't have any luck until a classmate of mine reached out and told me he may have found a space for sale. I'm going to call him John to protect his identity. John was a nice, calm, and friendly guy. He seemed genuine and somewhat trustworthy, so I followed up on his lead. One day after classes, John and I walked over to the dorms where he introduced me to a gentleman named Mike.
Hey, how are you?
There were 4 separate dorms in this huge block. Madame Tinubu Hall, which was a female dorm, Makama Hall, Shodende Hall, and Eninjoku Hall. They were all boys dorms. Mike's room was in Shodende Hall. Each room in the entire block was originally designed to accommodate two students. But as the demand increased and population exploded, they brought in bunk beds, making each a four-man room. The strain on the building was obvious. Each hallway, you know, had shared bathrooms that weren't in great condition. It wasn't the most conducive place to live, but it definitely beat having to spend 5 hours on the road every day. There was something peculiar about Mike's room. It didn't have two bunk beds like all the others. It had only two regular beds. And that made it even more attractive to me because it meant less people in the room. And I didn't have to deal with either myself or some other roommate climbing in and out of bed and, you know, bothering each other. Mike offered me the second bed, and for a good price. It was a great deal, so without hesitation, I made payment arrangements and I moved in as quickly as I could.
Yeah, I'll see you on Monday.
Mike was in his fourth year studying actuarial science. He was very calm, very friendly, very gentle in his tone. I felt right at home. Mike seemed like the kind of person that I could not only live with, but learn a lot from. It was a cool arrangement. About a week after I moved in, I met Mike's cousin, Daniel.
Hey, what's up, man?
Daniel was also in his fourth year. He was studying philosophy. Daniel spent a lot of time in our room, and then eventually he started staying over, except on the weekends. He would sleep on a mattress on the floor, and I mean, he never bothered me, so I didn't really mind. And he was also very gentle in his tone, you know, very quiet. I really enjoyed actually having both of them as roommates. As I settled in and began to participate in more campus activities, I joined the karate program at the sports center, which is about half a mile from my dorm. So after classes, I'll go to the sports center, you know, to my karate class for about an hour. We trained on most days until it started getting dark at about 6:30 p.m. and then returned to my dorm room. Mike used to tease me about it. He called me Karate Kid from time to time. He also asked me on numerous occasions why I didn't like to change at the sports center before returning to the dorms. You know, but I told him repeatedly that I didn't want to get my sweaty self back into my clothes. You know, it made more sense to just walk back in my karate gi, jump in the shower, and then change into my pajamas or whatever I was wearing for the evening. On my way back from the sports center, and on most days, there were usually a lot of guys hanging around the entrance of my dorm, shooting dice, smoking cigarettes, drinking, or, you know, just catcalling girls that were walking in. It was a normal scene, you know, and I never really paid much attention. I just used to walk by as quickly as possible, and, you know, and avoid having to make any eye contact with anyone. It was my first year, so most of these guys were much bigger than me. Not that I was afraid of them or anything, but yeah, I had seen them bully smaller guys like me on numerous occasions, you know, and I was also pretty confident that I could hold my own if it ever came down to a scuffle. So I wasn't really worried about, you know, having to deal with anyone, but I was also trained to avoid conflict. So, you know, I like to mind my business and I didn't want any trouble. On my way to class from my dorm, I had to walk past another all-male dorm called Mariri Hall. This was a notorious hall for rough boys and what I only thought of as stupid gangs at the time. So I knew to increase my pace to get past it as quickly as possible. I'd seen other students get bullied walking past Mariri and I never wanted to be a victim. One day, as I walked past Mariri, I noticed a group of guys that were sitting under a tree drinking and smoking. And unfortunately for me, I made eye contact with one of them. As soon as I made eye contact, he stood up and he began jogging towards me. Then another two followed. They increased the number and eventually they cornered me. And before I could even figure out what to do to get out of the situation, one of them snatched my baseball cap off my head and started walking away. And then the other two prevented me from following him. Then I noticed there were like maybe another 10 or 12 guys where the one who took my cap was walking to. You know, it seemed really organized and I definitely couldn't do anything to get my cap back. So I had to give it up. This must have been the first time in my life that I had been successfully bullied. It felt horrible. I felt helpless. I hated it. I was so mad as I proceeded to my class that I actually cried in anger. Even though I was coming from a very gentle background, you know, growing up in Kaduna and all, I was a tough kid. I was a martial artist, but I never ever been put in a real situation where I felt helpless. These guys are much bigger than I was, and I mean, there was really nothing I could do. I trusted that if it ever came down to a one-on-one, I'd probably beat any one of them, you know, because I was very unassuming. You know, most people would look at me and see, you know, a young kid. I was skinny, had a pretty mommy's boy's look, so they always underestimated me. You know, and here I was, walking away from my rear, bullied out of my baseball cap by a bunch of thugs, and I couldn't do anything about it. It made me really hate being on the campus, and I hated my dad even more for making me end up here. I remember mentioning the story to Mike and Daniel when I got back to my room and telling them how I was going to get my revenge, but they talked me out of it. Mike explained that I had to be careful on the campus, and he warned me to stay away from my Rary Hall, even if it meant walking the longer route to class. I wasn't one to back down easily, but I also wasn't a trouble seeker, so I took his advice and started walking the long route to class in order to avoid those annoying thugs at my Rary. One day, I was walking back to the dorms with a female friend of mine, and one of the guys hanging out at the entrance made an aggressive catcall at her. You know, my natural instinct in that situation, being, you know, a typical Kaduna boy, would have been to stop and ask if he had lost his mind. You know, but taking Mike and Daniel's advice, I chose not to respond. I also told her to ignore him and just keep walking. She hesitated for a moment, but decided to step up the pace and continue walking with me into the dorms. As we walked in, she grabbed and held onto my hand, and I could sense that she was nervous because she held on tightly. I wasn't quite sure why her reaction wasn't anger, but fear. So I just reassured her and told her not to worry about it, and, you know, that I was there to protect her if anything would happen, blah, blah, blah. She didn't stay longer than 5 minutes before asking to leave, and then she insisted on exiting the block from a different exit. I teased her a little bit about it, and I really didn't understand why she was being so paranoid. She also insisted that I walk her back to her dorm entrance before turning back to go to mine. You know, and it was all weird, but I was like, yeah, whatever, let's go. A few days later, on my way back from my karate class, I noticed the same group of guys at the dorm entrance. I planned to walk past them. Even if they'd bothered me, I was just going to apologize and keep it moving. I really wasn't trying to start or encourage any trouble. But as I got closer to the entrance, one of them noticed me, and then he yelled out,
"Hey, small boy, come here."
I knew it was me he was talking to, but I ignored the call and I just kept walking. Then he yelled again,
"Hey, are you mad? I said come here."
At this point, I couldn't ignore any longer, so I turned around and started walking slowly towards him. He started walking towards me as well, and as I got close enough, I said to him, "Why are you bothering me? What did I do to you?" Then he reached out and grabbed me by the neck and began shoving me backwards. While shoving me backwards, he said,
"Do you know who I am? Eh? Do you know who I am?"
I managed to break out of the hold, and still not wanting any trouble, I told him, "Please, just can you just leave me alone?" And then as I turned around in an attempt to walk away, he smacked me in the back of my head, and then he yelled,
"Where are you going? Come here! I'm talking to you, bastard."
I think the word bastard may have been my trigger when I was younger, because that was the tipping point. I lost it. So I turned around, looked him in the eye, and said, "Let me warn you. Don't ever try that shit with me, otherwise I will fuck you up." And then I heard Mike's voice in my head saying,
LD, don't try to fight those boys.
But my ego wouldn't allow me to be bullied like I was at Mareri Hall. I stood my ground. He was visibly thrown off. He wasn't expecting that at all. I could see the confusion in his gaze as he looked at me. He looked me up and down, and then he turned around to look at his boys, who, at this point, they had gathered behind him and around us in a circle. Then he looked back at me and said,
"Me? You were what? You were what?"
Then I repeated, slowly and calmly, "If you fucking try that shit with me again, I will fuck you up. I knew at this point I had embarrassed him in front of his group of friends by saying that. And it must have been worse for him because I was about 4 to 6 inches shorter than he was, and at least about 50 pounds lighter. And there I was, standing up to him, making threats. At this point, I could feel people around the area slowly stepping aside and making space for what was an obvious confrontation they didn't want a part of. I could also tell things weren't really going according to this dude's plan any longer, because I somehow had the upper hand by virtue of the surprise that I would even dare to challenge him. He probably just saw an opportunity to bully a young kid, you know, but his honor was being questioned at this point. And even if he hadn't planned to initially, he must have started feeling the pressure to follow through with beating me up. I noticed his hesitation because he realized for a quick moment that I could be a threat. I mean, hell, I was still standing there dressed up in my karate gi, so I bet it crossed his mind that this could go south for him, but all his friends were right there behind him, and I had made him look really bad. I sensed also that it was only a matter of time before he would charge at me, so I slowly assumed a guarding stance without looking awkward, and then I asked him, "What are you gonna do?" And just as I uttered the word "do," he charged at me, but I was quicker. Very well calculated. I took one step back and with my right leg returned to hit him with the Kakato Otoshigeri. That's Japanese for axe kick. To perform an axe kick, you start in a walking stance. You bring your knee up to your chest level. And when you reach the top of your kick, you pull it down upon your target as hard as you can. For maximum effect, you keep your foot pointed and deliver the blow with your heel. In regular combat, this is considered a dangerous kick and is usually not a go-to move as a first attack. But first of all, I wanted to really hurt him. And secondly, I needed to clear the doubts of anyone who was watching. Anyone else who may have considered bullying me in the future, or anyone who considered possibly jumping into this fight. My first move needed to be devastating. It was. My heel landed on his chest and he fell back to the ground. While he was on the floor, in obvious pain and confusion and still trying to gather himself to get back up, I kicked him in the face, sending him back down. And very calmly, I said to him, "Don't ever fuck with me. You don't know me. You just die for nothing." There was a silent pause for about 5 seconds. Everyone watching was in shock. It was a David and Goliath moment. And then I heard some people go, They were afraid for me and what I had just gotten myself into. But I was confident that the fight was over. I mean, my opponent was on the floor. His nose was bleeding. He was clearly devastated. I had proved my point. So I adjusted my gi and proceeded to walk back towards the entrance of the dorms. I knew nobody else wanted a piece of me in that moment, because the circle opened up for me to make my way through it. And as far as I was concerned, this was a victory. It felt like I had just gotten my revenge for not only the smack on my head and for him calling me a bastard, but for my baseball cap at my Ryrie Hall. As soon as I stepped into the doorway of the dorms, someone screamed, "Run! Run! Run!" And I noticed a scuffle beginning to build up behind me. I didn't look back. I realized my opponent and his gang had probably made the decision to give me a chase, so I ran. I ran as fast as I could, up the steps, around the corners, and straight up to my room. When I stepped inside my room, Mike was lying down on his bed. He looked tired, almost like he was waiting to fall asleep. I didn't want to disturb him, but I needed to warn him of the imminent threat that we were both facing should the mob behind me find the room.
Mike.
And just as I said, "Hey, Mike," I heard very loud banging on the room door and what sounded like someone trying to open the door from outside. I had locked the door behind me so they couldn't get in, but the banging got louder and louder. Mike calmly got up into a sitting position. He looked at me and he asked,
"Daddy, who is banging my door like that?"
I didn't really know how to respond. I just said,
It's those boys in front of the hall. He slapped my head, so I kicked him and then I ran.
Mike shook his head, slowly got up, but I could sense his countenance change rapidly as he walked towards the door. I was about to tell him not to open the door when he did, and in that moment, I just started looking around for anything I could use as a weapon to defend myself. I even considered jumping out of the window into the courtyard. We were on the first floor. Mike opened the door, and what happened next was truly shocking. Looking away from outside the door, Mike literally opened, reached out with his right hand, grabbed the first person his hand could reach, pulled him into the room, and slammed the door shut behind him. As soon as the guy looked up at Mike, I noticed the shock on his face. Then he tried to say something, and then Mike just gave him a headbutt on the face. Boom! And then he kicked him from the side, clearing his feet off the ground. It sent him flying in the air and landing on his side. It looked painful. Then Mike yelled, "Kneel down there!" at the guy. And like an obedient slave, the guy went on his knees and started begging. Mike then opened the door again and screamed out, "My room? My room? Una de mad?" I'm in complete shock. Mike was not in his usual cool and laid-back character. It was like watching Bruce Banner become the Hulk. He was loud. He looked aggressive and scary as hell. I just stood behind him with my back against the wall, in panic and just total confusion. This is not how I imagined things were going to play out. Then, almost as if the Hulk returned to Bruce Banner, in about 5 seconds, he walked back towards his bed and he sat down. Then he looked up at me and said in a very calm and more recognizable tone, "My room? My room?" And then he turned to the guy who was still obediently on his knees and bleeding from his nose at this point, and said to him,
"You are a dead man."
And then Mike just laid back down on his bed and turned his back to the guy. The guy looked up at me. I'm still in shock, but becoming more confident by the minute. I got a good look at him. It wasn't the guy I had attacked downstairs. This was one of his friends. I recognized him from what he was wearing. Shortly after, Daniel walked in. He didn't seem surprised. He looked at me and he just smiled. He looked at Mike, who was probably already asleep with his back turned. Yes, Mike slept off with this guy kneeling down in our room. And then Daniel turned back to look at the kneeling guest. And as soon as the guy made eye contact with Daniel, he attempted to say something, and Daniel literally slapped him and told him to shut up. Now, you have to understand what's going through my mind at this point. Mike didn't have a mobile phone, neither did Daniel, so I wasn't quite sure how Daniel understood what was going on. He basically walked into the room and just added to the intrigue. And then Daniel sat down, grabbed one of his textbooks from his book bag, and he started reading. He was reading a book. Now, I was sitting there in total confusion, trying to understand what I was witnessing. I eventually got up and, you know, changed clothes. Of course, I wouldn't dare step out of the room for fear of being attacked, so I couldn't even take a shower. I just sat on my bed, thinking of a million reasons for what I just witnessed. I just couldn't explain it. A few hours passed, and then I heard a gentle knock on the door. Daniel asked, "Who is that?" And then the voice said something I couldn't really make out. Then Daniel got up, opened the door, stepped out to speak to whoever it was. I couldn't see who it was. And then a moment later, he walked back in the room with what seemed like groceries. And then the next thing I noticed, he brought out a couple bottles of alcohol from one of the bags and placed them inside our fridge. Then he looked at our kneeling guests and then he said, "You can go." The dude got up, you know, without saying a word. He just limped out of the room. And then Daniel shut the door. It was about 10 p.m. Mike finally woke up about 10 minutes after Daniel let the guy go. And he had a smile on his face. Then he looked at me and said, you know, in the calmest tone, you know, which is what I was familiar with.
LD, don't be afraid. I like you. I like you a lot. In fact, from the first day I saw you, I took a liking to you. I know you're a JJC and you don't understand this place, but let me tell you something. You see, all these boys have been telling you they are very dangerous. Oh. Very dangerous boys. I told you to be careful with them. You have to listen to me when I tell you something. Because if you don't, you may not survive on this campus. Oh.
That night, he proceeded to school me on a lot of things. Things that I was truly only learning about for the first time. Mike explained to me that in universities and higher institutions in general, there's a thing called confraternities or secret cults. These confraternities or cults are essentially secret rival groups that are spread across university campuses nationwide. And they compete for everything, including girls, territories, money, political influence, and everything else that you can associate with gangs. He explained that they had different names and they had different codes. He even reminded me of occasions when he asked me to change my outfit. He never explained why, but you know, I used to trust his judgment. He was in year four. I thought it may have been a fashion thing, but as it turns out, each confraternity had a unique combination of colors that was a way for them to either identify or recognize one another, something like that. So you could think of it as like the Crips were in blue and the Bloods were in red. It was a similar concept, except there are many of these confraternities and each one has like a different code. Oftentimes I was dressed up in colors that if I had stepped out in could have possibly gotten me attacked or maybe even killed. And I had absolutely no clue. It was a long night and a very long conversation with Mike. I mean, Daniel would chip in every now and again, but Mike did most of the talking. He eventually explained to me that this was his second attempt at going to university. He told me he was kicked out of the previous university he attended in the first semester of his final year for illegal activities related to cultism and confraternities. Then he lifted up his shirt and pointed at scars on his stomach. I'd seen those scars before, but I didn't think much of them. I just thought, you know, maybe had an accident or something. But he told me that night that he got them from being shot in the stomach and that he was lucky to still be alive. After giving me a long, detailed, and very scary lecture about confraternities and cultism, he gave me some tips on how to navigate the campus. You know, he reassured me also, and this is very important, that the boys that attacked me would never harass me again. But that I had to make a peace offering to their leader. So I asked, you know, what I needed to do, and he told me to bring one bottle of alcohol and four packs of Benson and Hedges cigarettes every Sunday for the rest of the semester. And that if I didn't, he couldn't guarantee my safety. From everything Mike told me, I deduced somehow that he must have been a hardcore gang member or cultist or, you know, confraternity head and a leading member of one of the prominent ones. He had to be. I mean, this was his eighth year in university. And the way he handled the situation was very mafia movie-like. I mean, this stuff only happens in movies. He went to sleep backing the enemy. Regular people don't do stuff like that. I was just confused by everything that I witnessed. He never told me which confraternity he belonged to. And I didn't have the courage to ask. All I had at that point was his promise of protection and the instructions he gave me on how to stay safe. For the rest of the semester, at least. Now, through my first semester, every now and again, Mike would tell me to go home for the weekend or give specific instructions to stay away from the campus. You know, he would say things like, don't come back till Tuesday, or, you know, stay in class tonight if you're going to be there past 10 p.m. And I always listened to him. I never had the courage to go against anything he ever asked me to do. I had some nerdy friends that I used to pass some of the warnings to, but they rarely ever listened. A few of the times I warned them, they didn't listen, and they almost got caught in a crossfire between rival confraternities. But being the geeks that they were, they charged most of it to coincidence. I always wondered what would happen after Mike and Daniel graduated. And then I was all alone again. But then I also began to pay attention to my environment and learn how to navigate through the madness. I learned a lot that year. The culture shock was intense, and I had to switch my routine into becoming a much more private and much less visible person. I stopped going to my karate class. I spent more and more time in music studios outside of the campus, and lots of time at architecture studio while on the campus. And it helped me stay out of trouble. Mike had also taught me all the signs and what to watch out for in order to avoid being forcefully recruited by any of the confraternities. That year, I was walking around with a lot of paranoia and distrust in everyone and everything. It made me hate the campus even more, but I didn't have much of a choice. Confraternities had conflicts regularly on the university campus. On some occasions, it ended up in multiple fatalities. I remember one time there was a raid on my block by certain members from a particular confraternity, and they took the lives of 26 students. I don't think you heard me. 26 people died in one attack. Their bodies were brought out on like bloodied mattresses. Some of them, you know, had been apparently or allegedly shot. You know, others were stabbed or like hacked to death with machetes. It was horrible. The sight of those bodies being brought out of the dorms, it haunts me till this day. Fast forward a few months. One day I was walking down the hallway, heading back to my dorm room. I must have been rapping out loud because I had headphones on, you know, listening to hip-hop instrumentals, not really paying much attention to what was going on around me. I was reciting a new rap verse that I just written, and from nowhere, I felt someone yank off my headphones from behind. So I turned around, and it was the guy I fought. He gave me the poker face for a moment. I was scared and almost pissing my pants. This was unexpected. And then I heard Mike's voice in my head again.
LD, don't try to fight with those boys.
I imagined that he was probably back for his revenge, so I was already constructing an apology in my head. And then he just switched to a smile and said, "You're a rapper. Will you rap for me?" I wasn't sure if he was serious or if this was part of his plot to kick my ass. So I said, "Hey, I'm sorry about..." But before I could complete my sentence, he said, "Forget all that. Just spit a verse for me." I started off very awkwardly, but I looked around and didn't notice any backups for him. So I just thought to myself, "Hey, worst case scenario, I'll kick his ass again and make a run for it." So a few seconds passed, and then I thought, hey, why not? You know, I started rapping, and we ended up hanging out in the hallway for almost 20 minutes. He seemed genuinely fascinated at my rap verses, and he told me I was the best Nigerian rapper he had ever heard, and then he encouraged me to include more pidgin in my raps. He eventually gave me a handshake. You know, he told me his name was Gabriel, and he was like, all right, you know, see you later, and he just walked away. I stood there in shock for another minute, just trying to understand what just happened. I was definitely happy the tension between us had, you know, was finally diffused, but I still had my reservations. I was walking around paranoid, waiting for the moment we'd cross paths, and it finally happened. But it wasn't anything like what I thought, and I was just really surprised. But I wasn't going to stop being paranoid now. I mean, this could be part of Gabriel's, you know, plot to catch me unguarded, or as Mike had warned me about, maybe a plot to somehow forcefully recruit me into his group. So, Mike and Daniel graduated at the end of the year. I was sad to see them leave, and I was even more worried about what would happen to me after they were gone. My protective shield left with them, and I felt very vulnerable. I decided that I wasn't going to live in the dorms any longer. It was just too dangerous. So I started seeking alternative accommodation on the campus. I eventually rented a room in the university staff quarters. I started seeing Gabriel more often. Every time I saw him, he would stop whatever he was doing, gather people around, and tell me to spit a verse or two. He became a huge supporter of my early music, and he actually went on to become my go-to guy whenever I sensed trouble on the campus. We became friends. He even offered to be our bodyguard when we started doing our first few campus events. He never tried to recruit or initiate me. The first recognized confraternity was started by Professor Wole Soyinka, who also happens to be Africa's first Nobel laureate. The confraternity was started in 1952. He started it with a group of six friends, and it was called the Pirate Confraternity. The Pirate Confraternity started at what is known today as the University of Ibadan in the southwest region of Nigeria. And they proved popular among students because of their values and what they stood for. You know, they fought for equality and better representation of students' needs on the campus. And, you know, they assimilated people regardless of religion, tribe, or social class. Membership was open to, you know, any promising male student, but selection was very stringent and most applicants were denied. The one thing that they were known for was that academic standards needed to be very high, and you needed to be of a certain intellectual level to be initiated as a member. For almost 20 years, the Pirates were the only confraternity on Nigerian campuses. In 1972, Bolaji Kiru and several others were expelled from the Pirates for failing to meet expected standards. And in response to this, Kiru started another confraternity called the Buccaneers. More fractions and confraternities began to spring up because members of the new groups didn't meet the high academic and intellectual standards set by the Pirates. They considered the original Pirates organization to be somewhat elitist and began recruiting members to their own groups with less stringent rules. As new groups emerged, intergroup tensions started building up, and it led to a lot of fighting. And the fighting got worse over the years. By the early 1980s, confraternities had spread throughout the over 300 institutions of higher education in Nigeria. Military leaders began to see confraternities as a way to check the student unions and university staff, who were, at the time, the only organized group that openly opposed military rule. The confraternities were provided payment and weapons to use against student activists and to maintain a level of fear among students and university staff. As if that wasn't unfortunate enough, the weapons were often used in what had now become very deadly inter-confraternity rivalries. The fact that a lot of the confraternities had government connections also meant that they were usually protected and most of their atrocities were ignored. Today, confraternities have taken many different shapes in Nigeria. They exist on and off campuses, some of them even in the Niger Delta, as militants and kidnappers. What started off as a brotherhood with a seemingly positive purpose took a bad turn and is responsible for over 10,000 deaths nationwide. It gave birth to organizations that most consider responsible for rape, kidnappings, robberies, and political assassinations. But just like any gang, cult, or confraternity, not every member is a bad person or had bad intentions when they became confraternity members. Some really had no choice. It was a matter of life and death for a lot of people. Sometimes it's just a function of the society in which you find yourself, you know, where you live, where you go to school, or just peer pressure. It could have been for me if I wasn't lucky enough to have a Mike and Daniel, who not only protected me from things that I didn't understand at the time, but also taught me that it was a bad idea to become a member. Thank you for listening to this episode of Nigerian American. Please subscribe and feel free to share this podcast. You can also reach us via email at NigerianAmericanPodcast@gmail.com. My name is LD. Oh, and by the way, I'm going on vacation and may be unable to drop another episode next weekend. I'll see what I can do to bring things back to a weekly cadence, but Nigerian American will be released every 2 weeks from now on. Thanks for listening.